In many parts of the country, planters are rolling. In this episode, Helena product specialist Brad Hammes from Iowa and Helena product manager Adam Bush from Texas remind us about the fundamentals of a good fertility program and the importance of incorporating the 4R system into your 2024 crop program. It's no secret that over the past 20 years, technological advancements in agriculture has exploded. And along with those advancements, growers have accumulated volumes of data. However, navigating all of this data can sometimes be a challenge for producers. On this episode, Helena AgriIntelligence team members Joel McCormick from Illinois and Brad Dressler from Pennsylvania help us navigate the data mystery through some unique tools and people from Helena. Plus, commodity analyst Jody Lawrence joins us from Nashville to discuss the latest USDA planting intentions report and how it will impact grain markets for 2024. All right, folks, we're going to be recording here live in our booth here for the FieldLink podcast studio, and want to welcome everybody here from here to Houston as we introduce a couple of our guys, our experts here. We're going to talk about utilizing data to help you produce a more profitable crop. And joining me today in the FieldLink podcast studio here in Houston is Joel McCormick. Joel works for AgriIntelligence in Illinois. Joel, welcome to FieldLink.
Thanks, Bill.
As well as Brad Dressler. Brad works in the eastern part of the United States. And Brad, welcome to FieldLink.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, guys, it's great to have you both here as we talk a little bit about data and how data can impact overall customer profitability. You know, it's a big mystery out there when we talk about data. It's the hot buzzword. There's a lot of precision solutions out there for folks to choose for them and navigate through. And there's a lot of data. And we're going to talk a little bit about that today. So, guys, why don't you give us a quick overview of the AgriIntelligence platform. And Brad, tell us a little bit about AgriIntelligence and how important it is for our growers.
Sure. So AgriIntelligence is really core to Helena and our business with our customers. Helena's been involved with Precision Ags from the mid-90s. The brand name AgriIntelligence was launched the year 2002. So they've been doing it for over 20 years now. A lot of the brands you see, such as our High Ground, True Yield, Seed Strong stuff, all that got launched a few years ago. And a lot of time and energy and knowledge goes into the whole operation. And the whole purpose is really to try to bring value to this data that we're talking about and help a customer be more profitable, see a better ROI on their investments. So that's really what it's geared towards for our customers day in and day out.
Brad, I think you bring up a great point. You know, and that's a lot of, I guess, things that might not always be talked about, but Helena's been playing in this precision space for a very long time. Frankly, we were one of the innovators in there for over, like you mentioned, 20, 25 years.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They've kind of paved the way in terms of the software and technology that goes into it. And they've invested heavily in it over the past 20 years. And it's not a big flashy program. We just have the people in place to get the stuff done and provide the service.
Yeah, Brad, you talked about something really important there. And Joel, tell us a little bit about the people. I think the people is the key here. There's a lot of moving targets in terms of technology and how that all comes into play. But when we talk about AgriIntelligence and precision agriculture, AI is set up with the right people.
That's right, Bill. When I first started with Helena in 2006, we really started to invest in the AgriIntelligence space as far as the people go. We started to put AI techs, as we call them now, at locations to help facilitate pulling data into the system, right? Analyzing that data and helping the salespeople interpret that information and deliver it to the customer, right? Which was what we found we needed to do. We have salespeople that are experts in a lot of things, and we try to take a little bit off of their plate where we can to help specialize in that AgriIntelligence space and the interpretations of the data and understanding what we can derive from that, right? So that's been widely adopted across Helena at this point, all the way from the East Coast to the West Coast, where we have AI techs in a lot of branches at this point, most branches that are able to work with the growers directly, pull the data in, and give them some feedback.
Yeah, I think that's an important point is there's a lot of wonderful I guess, software technology out there, but it's the people that can interpret the data to help, I guess, make a little sense of it.
That's right.
Yeah. So, guys, let's talk about the importance of data. You know, you mentioned, Helena, we've been doing this for a very long time. We've got a lot of data out there. Talk to us, Brad, a little bit about the data and what, I guess, you've experienced and what your customers have experienced, and how are you using this information?
Yeah, so one thing that's really key to the data and that what we work with every day is the AgriIntelligence platform. It's really a closed loop system. So we're not just pulling one piece of data. You know, we're not just looking at soil data. We're not just looking at yield data. We like to be involved in all aspects of that, follow that through the year, because as much of us know, you can have everything perfect in terms of soil fertility, but if Mother Nature doesn't cooperate, you might not build a crop. If your soil's out of whack, but your foliar feeding something, you might not have the yields you expect. So in terms of the data and actually having the value on it, we like to track that the whole way through the year. We like to have the soil data, the tissue data, the seed scripts, and finalize that with the yield at the end of the year. But just being able to pull all those pieces together to help tell that story, we don't want just one piece of the puzzle. We like to have the whole puzzle. So that's been key for us.
So Joel, tell us a little bit about some of the data, some of the things that you've learned. You're specifically working in Illinois. Tell us about, I guess, a journey there, maybe some customers that some data that you've pulled that it's helped them improve their yield.
Yeah. So this last year, I had the opportunity to work with one of our locations and some new customers to AgriIntelligence. They'd been customers of that branch, but we really hadn't utilized their data to the fullest extent. And when I started working with them, they started sharing some of that data with us. So they'd been collecting yield data for 3 or 4 years, right? But they hadn't been doing anything with it. So we were able to pull that into our system. We started pulling high ground samples, their soil samples, and utilizing those as well. But what they really wanted to do, they had gotten a new planter and they wanted to utilize that data to drive their seeding scripts, right? And so we started putting those scripts together. We sat down together, we talked about their operation, their farm specifically, field by field, and we were able to put together the seeding scripts that they felt comfortable with their varieties, right? They implemented those. We pulled that as applied data back into our system after planting. And then at the end of the season, we got their yield data back. And it was really exciting for me because I stopped to visit them while they were harvesting. And one of the brothers got out of the truck and he said, "I cannot believe how good of a year we've had with our yields," right? And
he
was contributing a lot of that to their seeding scripts. So at the end of the year, when we got all the data put together, we analyzed that through True Yield, and we were able to compare their yields at the different seeding rate ranges.
Okay, sure.
And show them that, yes, indeed, where they had planted the higher populations, they got more yield. And where they weren't able to produce as much, we had backed off some of the populations, and those had done a great job as well, but just not as high a yielding area.
Sure.
So we hadn't invested as much in those areas, right? And so we were able to put some ROI to that for their operation. So we just sat down here a few weeks ago and did their seeding scripts. We made a few slight changes from information that we learned from last year,
yep.
And we're working into the 24 season now. So that's exciting.
Well, I think that's a great story, especially, you know, let's pause for a second and go back to the 23 growing season. That wasn't exactly the greatest environment in Illinois last year.
That's right. We actually had, I was out there, we flew their fields with our drone, get some imagery for them. And one of the brothers stopped and visited with me, and he was concerned at that point, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we'd been dry through May and most of June, and he was really concerned. And it was just a complete shift going into that harvest season. Now, we got some rains fairly timely, but we didn't see, a lot of people are concerned, especially if they go higher in populations, that's going to, you know, hurt them in a dry situation. Obviously, you have to take that into account that can happen.
It
right?
can happen. Yeah, it's Mother Nature, right?
That's right. We got to be prepared for all of those contingencies.
Right.
But if we can, you know, plan as well as we can for those situations, we should weather that storm.
Yeah,
right?
I think that's a great story. And that's just one component of the AgriIntelligence system. Brad, let's talk a little bit, shift gears kind of through that, you know, that AI journey, if you will. Extractor is a a tool that's in the portfolio for AgriIntelligence. Tell us a little bit about Extractor and maybe share a story, a customer experience that you guys had.
Sure. So Extractor is tissue sampling for all intents and purposes. One thing that sets Extractor apart from just conventional tissue sampling is everything's geo-referenced. All right. Okay. So you can track this throughout the year, same exact point. You can overlay that over top of a soil sample point to see what the correlation between soil fertility and your plant health is. One thing that we like to say is the Extractor is basically a report card for your soil fertility and for your plant health. You know, it gives you a snapshot of any moment in time throughout the growing season, helps tell that story. Again, we talk about telling the story. You know, just because your soul's right, if Mother Nature doesn't want to cooperate, guess what? It might not, that fertility might not translate into plant tissue. So we have a large plot that we do in Pennsylvania every year. It's a kind of a big showcase plot for us. And we use this to tell a story this year. As much of the growing area, we didn't have a great year. We had a month without rain. This particular area had frost on it. It was planted the third week of April. And had frost on it, two hail events, and a month of no rain. Our early tissue samples at V5, if you take it, look terrible. I mean, everything was in the red. There was absolutely no way you thought these plants were gonna produce a crop. So the main driving force of that, because we were in tune with the field, it was dry, right? No soil solution, no moisture there to take it up into the plant. So we were able to pivot and we started making foliar applications on those corn plants. And we were still able to produce roughly 200 bushel corn crop, which nobody would have bet that at that particular point in time. But the nice thing with Extractor is, like I said, you get that snapshot in season, see what that plant health is, and you can utilize that to make decisions for post-herbicide applications, late season fungicide applications, and use different HPG products to address the needs in the crop at that particular point in time. So,
you know, you bring up a great point as it relates to, you know, in season journey and utilizing Extractor to identify some agronomic needs about that crop right then, right there. And Joel, we had some guys on here earlier talking about genetics. Matt Scuffum, who's one of our seed managers in the north, he talked about the changing germplasm and some of the needs, agronomic needs, certain hybrids and varieties need, but as it's tough to predict exactly what they're going to need, but Extractor allows us to, I guess, from a scientific standpoint, tell us exactly what's going on inside that plant.
That's right. Yeah. What better way to track what's happening through that growing season than to be taking those samples throughout, you know, at the same point through the field, you know, to see that journey that plant goes on, but then also to use that as you go back into the next year to help predict what could happen in the next crop, right?
Right.
There's been a lot of work that's been done with some of our plots that we've taken Extractor sites on to look at things. We've learned a lot about the relationships between these nutrients and yield, right? And that we continue to evolve and produce better results with that Extractor report and look for different ways to compare these nutrients and what's gonna impact that growing crop.
Guys, I know that y'all have, as we talked earlier, you've collected data from AgriIntelligence for 20, 25 years. Tell us a little bit about this data, some of the things that you've learned as you compile all of this information. You know, does it give us any indicator, hey, you're typically, or could the predictability of being short, for example, in zinc or copper, share some insight that you've learned by collecting all this data?
So we do a lot of grower meetings in the Northeast, and it's always interesting to sit down in front of a group of growers and ask them, what do you suspect your soil is going to be deficient in, or what do you suspect you might be lacking in terms of plant tissue? We have a lot of dairy in my area still, and there's a large driving force to make sure we're controlling phosphorus and so forth. But it's really interesting because I can pull a high ground summary report for the past 5, 10, 15 years and lay in front of a group of growers, and everybody thinks they're going to be in high excess of phosphorus. In reality, greater than 50% is below optimal. In terms of, that's just one example from my area. I don't know, Joel, if you have any specific examples that you like to hit on or not.
It varies. Up in Wisconsin, I cover that area as well, and there's quite a bit of dairy, and we look at that as well. And I've got locations that are on opposite sides of that state, mm-hmm. and to see the kinds of soils that they're on and the variability within a few hours drive, I mean, that's really telling. You know, we work with our agronomists to to build equations that are going to address that as well as we can, right? But we have the versatility and the adaptability within those equations to address all of those needs, right? Because you have those fields where you don't hardly have anything. And you have to take into account what their management program is, right?
Right.
Because even within those dairy areas and that, you have some that just hold that phosphorus better, or it's more available, right? So, yeah.
There's a good point there that I just want to hit on is anything when we're talking agri-intelligence, this is not a one-size-fits-all program.
Right.
When we talk with this data, we custom tailor every single customer to every single acre, depending on what type of data they have, how accurate is that data, you know, and help them scrub through that and actually bring some value out of it. So everything is custom tailored. There's no one-size-fits-all
program. I'm glad you brought that up, Brad, because I think that's really important for producers to understand that with agri-intelligence, it's really about their farm, their field, and their acre. That being said, when we do collect all of this data from a broad range, it can help us as agronomists and as researchers better understand, wow, there's a trend here. There's a trend in sulfur. There's a trend in, boron, whatever. And that information allows our Helena Products group to do some more research, investigate, maybe find some new products.
Absolutely.
That could best fit that producer long-term.
Yeah. See what those opportunities are. You know, for instance, if we're talking plant tissue and extractor, we look at nitrogen to sulfur ratios a lot. And what we're finding is that there's not nearly enough sulfur out there, right? We don't get any free sulfur anymore. So we really put a large emphasis on our growers and make sure they're putting that down. So
yeah. Neat area. Guys, what's the future look like as it relates to agri-intelligence? What are some tools that, and I guess information that you're looking at as we get into 24 with growers?
I'd say one thing is with agri-intelligence, we're pulling a lot of data from a lot of different sources. You know, we work very well with all the big names out there in terms of software, whether it's John Deere or Climate or whatever. We work really nice with all those folks. So we're utilizing a lot of this data not only to make the agronomic decisions, but going forward, this data is going to play a huge role in sustainability and carbon marketing and so forth. So what that looks like right now, I don't exactly know.
Sure.
We just need to be open-minded in that journey. It might be a winding road for over the next few years before we actually get there. So,
yeah. How about for Joel, you in the Midwest?
So one of our big initiatives this year is to help growers collect as much of the data as they can. Because going back to that carbon piece, we have found that the more information we have, the easier it's going to be for them to qualify and get into some of these carbon markets,
yeah.
Right? You know, anything from a tillage pass to a cover crop or an application of fertilizer or chemical, right? We need to track product, rate, timing of all of that as closely as we can so that we can provide that to these models that are going to be analyzing this and to give them feedback on and where they qualify and what they qualify for.
So what are you guys doing to make that collection of data easier for the grower today?
So a lot of that revolves around telematics in the machine. So, right, we want seamless data transfer. We don't want anybody to have to be clicking buttons on a monitor screen, make sure they're doing the right client farm field. We want all that to be automatic. So we're utilizing a few different pieces of equipment to do that. I mentioned John Deere, for instance. You know, we're pretty good at bringing that data directly in. There's some other ones out there as well, but trying to make it, number one, seamless for the growers so that their operators, equipment drivers are not having to do that manual data entry, making it easier for our agri-intelligence technicians to get that into AI 360. And then actually turning that around and putting it in a usable form for them to be actually do.
Yeah, I think the ultimate theme here is how can we make it simpler? How
exactly.
can we make it easy for the producer? And Joel, going back to that people side, having the people, the boots on the ground to help interpret the data and share that story with the grower.
Right. I mean, one of the things that we're doing along with that is using our AgBytes database. So everything gets tied back to that AgBytes database. So we have a consistent name for every product that we can compare across the county, the state, the country, right? If we need to start doing some of those analysis and working with growers that decide to pool their data with us to help them analyze some of those things a little bit more concisely.
When we talk about this whole space, and data, as I mentioned, and when we opened, data is the buzzword. You know, I guess our goal, if I'm hearing you guys right, is how can we make it simple? How can we make it easy? But more importantly, how can we make the data turn into profit for that grower.
Exactly. You asked about what's the future look like. I see us being more as a partner going forward with the grower and bringing value to that data, you know, because unless you have somebody on staff at an operation that's actually crunching the numbers, it's hard for them to do that and take the time to do it or have the understanding to do it. So that's where we come into play and help them put value on that.
Yeah, so, you know, I talk to different growers across the country from time to time, and we talk about, well, I've had this precision tool on my planter or on my combine, but I don't know where it's at. What to do with it. It's interesting when we talk to the agri-intelligence technicians that you mentioned, Joel, where they're able to go pull SD cards out of combines that maybe collect 3 years of data. There's a lot of good information out there. It's only good if we use it. Well, guys, I want to thank you for joining us here on this episode of FieldLink in front of our live audience here at the Commodity Classic here in Houston, Texas. Looking forward to the rest of the great convention here and talking to many producers across the country. Thanks for joining us. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the FieldLink podcast studio. Today, we're excited to talk to a couple of folks about fertility. It's a very important piece. Today, we have joining us from Iowa is Brad Hammes. Brad is a product specialist for Helena, as well as Adam Bush. Adam Bush is a product manager from Texas. Guys, welcome to the FieldLink podcast studio.
Thanks for letting us be here. Glad to be here.
Awesome. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about fertility. You know, as growers get ready for planting 24, there's a lot of choices to be made, and we're going to visit a little bit about, you know, fertility plans and really what kind of goes into a good process in term determining, you know, what's the right strategy for you from an environmental perspective, as well as taking advantage of what's really out there in your field today. So Brad, joining us here from Iowa. Brad, let's talk a little bit about some of the basics that growers want to maybe consider for 2024.
Sure. And Bill, I think it goes back to block. The good teams always block and tackle well, right? And it's really about having that good foundation of fertility from your soil. But even more importantly, leaning in, how can we utilize 4Rs type strategy, right? How can we, and really in my mind, when I think about 4Rs, it's really 3+1, right? Because I always feel like if you get the right time and the right source and the right place, that's what allows you to do a more efficient rate. And I think at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is not just put more fertilizer on the field, but how do we get more crop nutrition into our plants, right? When I talk to growers about their fertility, I really talk about nutritional programs. Because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how much fertilizer we spread on the ground, it's about how much of that can we get into our plants. And that's where I think Helena can help make some differences between our precision offerings, between some of the different products, and the ways that we approach what a fertility program can look like.
Adam, you know, Brad talked a little bit about some of our precision programs that can help answer some of those kind of questions. What do you do in South Texas as it relates to fertility programs, as a tying that into the agri-intelligence offerings?
Yeah, I mean, Iowa is a different territory, right, than Texas, but we're all doing the same thing. We're focusing on agronomy, and one thing that we're looking at is using things like, in our portfolio, high ground or extractor. So we're looking at soil sampling and tissue sampling to really aid us and guide us in what we're doing. It's really important for us to make a good agronomic decision and making sure that we're putting out the right things, because, you know, we're not just doing what granddad did 50 years ago. We're using actual data to out decide what we're going to be putting out.
Speaking about data, what kind of things have you, I guess, learned, Adam, in Texas by utilizing a lot of this data over the last several years?
Well, I mean, I think it's important for us to look at something like a high ground map book. You know, one thing that we struggle with constantly is our high pHs, right? We've got high pHs, and we know that from an agronomy level, a pH of above 7, you're not getting the zinc out there that you need. So, you know, being able to identify the CECs, because I've got territory that may have low CECs and as low as 2. You know, it's fine beach sand. Well, you've got no nutrient holding capacity in that. But then I also have things like a higher CEC in the 20s where, you know, you may be stuck and not all your nutrients aren't being released. So that's where it becomes important for us to decide what we're doing with a high ground map book. I mean, also identifying something like salt spots.
Right.
You know, we always limit ourselves with water in Texas. We're always fighting for it, and we're constantly putting out salt. a lot of the time.
Sure.
And so being able to defend against that is really important.
Well, I think in having that information at your hands can help you and your sales team make better choices and decisions for those growers. Brad, what kind of data, leaning on the data that you found across Iowa, Illinois, and in the northern area, Wisconsin, and so forth, that you've experienced, what are some deficiencies that I guess your team's discovered here in the last couple of years?
Yeah, that's a good question, Bill. I think one of the things, and we just had some training on this here about a month ago now, where a lot of times what we run into is high magnesium in our soil. So it's relatively high when you compare it to what calcium looks like. And sometimes that can cause issues with soil structure, can cause issues with potassium uptake, right? So that goes back into, it's not about how much fertilizer is in my soil, it's about how much nutrition get in my plants. Right. And I think utilizing that data, like what Adam was talking about, that's what really allows us to help our customers make the best economic decisions, where if they're going to invest in their crop and invest in their nutritional program, what's that place that I need? You know, is it a really high pH spot in the field where I need to target more zinc, or I need to look at a different micronutrient, or is it a part of my field where I have really high yield potential and it might make more sense in a variable rate application to put a little bit more nutrition into that part of the field so that I can really capitalize on the productivity of that. But I would say that a lot of times we're seeing a lot of those basic issues, right? Where it comes down to, I guess, pun intended,
right?
The base saturations. Right? Am I looking at my calcium, my magnesium, my potassium? Those are some of the big issues that we've seen. And I would say also an overall trend of lower soil test levels on potassium and phosphorus. I think over these past several years, you know, we just came out of a time when commodity prices were a little better, right? And growers were investing more in fertilizer, looking at more build rates on their soil tests. But we were, prior to that, in a market where growers maybe weren't putting out as much fertilizer, and we're going back into that same type of a more challenged market where growers are evaluating that fertilizer investment a little bit differently. And I think that's moved us into this trend of seeing a downward movement in our average soil test levels on P and K. And that's certainly going to be a critical issue in maintaining the yield levels that we need to really support farm productivity.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you know, one of the unique things that's we've been talking about and adding recently is a product called Resurge. And now Resurge, we've released that product a couple of years ago. It's starting to really take over across the nation as an additive. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. But it's our humic, but it has some special characteristics. And Adam Bush, can you talk to us a little bit about Resurge and why it's so unique on the marketplace?
Yeah, so Resurge itself, it's our humic granule. I think what makes it special, you know, it's a 70% material. What really kind of stands out is the ability for it to not bind with urea. You know, you can put it with urea and we don't worry about it sticking together. That's not something that we've seen in the past with other humics in general. The low dust is another thing for us. You know, nobody likes dirty equipment.
Right.
And whenever you can actually spray it and you don't see a cloud of dust behind it, it's a pretty impressive thing for us.
Yeah, the handling of this product is really unique. Tell us about the size and structure of this particular product, Adam.
So, you know, it's a real uniform granule. The SGN is somewhere between, I think, 240. Okay. So real round and uniform pearl.
Yeah.
And you're not seeing jagged edges. So really, it has an ability to flow in a lot of different applications, whether you're looking at it as a straight broadcast application or even something in through an air seeder. Now, that's not something that we have a lot in our market,
right.
But we do have that capability for it to be put out in that manner.
Yeah, you mentioned air seeders, and you know, Brad, you have a few more up in Iowa, definitely a lot of them out west in South Dakota, the Montana area, and heck, now we've got a label for Resurge in Canada, which is really being introduced across those plains throughout the Canadian market for wheat growers and pulse growers up there. Brad, talk to us about some of the convenience factors your guys are talking about Resurge.
Yeah, sure. One of the things that it always makes me laugh when I think about in the product development phase of research, talk about that air seeder, and when you're slinging fertilizer through that planter that fast, and it has impact, right? That was one of the big concerns they had, is they needed to make a strong enough granule to handle that and not break down and create that dust, which could plug up your air seeder and cause problems during planting. And that's one of the things they actually tested it. They shot it out of a pellet gun, right into a cement wall, just to test how much impact can it handle before it has any issues. And they found that it was going to stand up to that level of impact that you get through that application. So that gave me a lot of confidence in just that little bit quirky, little anecdotal aspect of it. But that made me like talking about it for sure. otherwise, the convenience, I think one of the biggest things, because we've used our HEMIC products for a long time.
25 years or so.
Probably 70 to 80 million acres of cropland in the United States. One of the new improvements on research, in addition to being low dust, is the quick release. You know, one of the things that we've seen with humic materials, by their nature, they take a little while to break down in the soil. In our previous formulations, where it was a sized aspect of the ore, we would see 2 to 3 years of normal moisture conditions before we get complete breakdown and release of all the good stuff out of that granule. Whereas with research, now we get that in 1 year. Right, so now we're going to have a more consistent result in one season. So if a grower wanted to try it for the first year, a more consistent result from that would look more a lot like our long-term yield data average. But also for growers that are renting ground, right, and you maybe don't want to invest in something that might come due or come to fruition 2 to 3 years down the road. Once you get into a system on something like that, it can work. With our previous products and this family. But with research, we do see that quick release, and that's been a huge benefit for us. And the other piece of it that really makes a big difference is, you talked about, not all humic acids are created equally.
Right.
Right. And that comes in really, I would say, two different phases. One is what you start with determines what you can get. Right. And there's a lot of different parts of the world where you can find humic acids, humic ore deposits. But that doesn't mean that they're all created with the same ability to hold nutrients, ability to give value to a crop. And that's one of the place that we mine our materials, that we get our materials from in the New Mexico humic mining area, makes a big difference, right? And that has to do with what types of plants decompose to ultimately create these materials and that.
What was there millions of years ago?
Exactly, yeah. I always give the reference, and you think about like what the Everglades are now, if you fast forward a couple hundred million years, and that could potentially be a humic deposit, okay. Right? It's that level of organic matter we think of like a swamp right now. You fast forward that, you dry it out, you compress it, right? That's what that process initially would have looked like. But then all the conditions that happen between then and now give us some aspect of what that humic quality might be like from just the base ore source. How much charge is there? What parts of it would impact plant development, right? So that's one. And then the other part is you have to understand how to handle it. Right? Right. There's some definitely some negative aspects. It's literally a combustion reaction. These are carbon-based materials, and they have oxygen-containing functional groups, and if you heat them up too much, you gas off CO2, mm-hmm. right? So if you heat these things to dry them, to process them, you can actually diminish the quality of what they can bring to your crop. And we have a lot of confidence with this, you know, like you said, 25 years of working with these materials and understanding that they air dry all these materials. There's no heat applied to them artificially to help them become in a form that they can be applied to a field. So we start out with a great material, and we go through a very rigorous testing and handling process to make sure that what delivers to the field has that same, from what we see, usually about a 5% or so yield increase. And in most of the corn markets that I deal with, that's going to put you in that 10 to 10 plus bushel yield range.
Wow.
And that's what we've seen for the data set that I get to work with for 15 years or so. Sure. We've seen that average 10 bushels.
Adam, we're hearing about these 10, 15 bushels, a lot of cases in the Iowa market, the central Corn Belt, Texas, and the South. You work in New Mexico as well. What kind of results are you seeing?
We're seeing it all the way across the board. It's a great product for us, and it becomes particularly important whenever you're talking about nutrient use efficiency. Everyone worries about the cost of fertilizer today.
Right.
We've seen steady increases just constantly, and how can you get the best bang for your buck? And really, it's an application that I feel. You can't make the wrong application with that of research. It doesn't matter if we're talking going on vegetables. It doesn't matter if we're talking about citrus or pecans or any type of row crop. I cover all those. And the ability for us to put out one product that does a multitude of different things is really important for us in making sure that we get the best efficiency in our fertilizer with an application. We talked about functional groups, or Brad did. And, the best way I can put it is that humic granule is kind of like a cucklebur, right? And if you think of all those little points on the end, it's positive and negative charges, allowing us to bind nutrients and help it bring it into that plant. So it's got a storied history of success, and it's something we see in Texas and New Mexico constantly.
And Adam, I think there's a lot of confusion in the marketplace. Products like Resurge and HydroHumic, they get thrown into a bucket of just another humic. But
In this case, it's really not. It all comes back to where it's mined and that history that Brad talked about. What kind of imitators are you seeing out there, and how different are they compared to a product like Research?
It's really different, because if you look at that fingerprint, that NMR fingerprint of where it stands, it's not going to be, not all functional groups are created equal. So really, it's something that it's not just, well, this is black and this is black, how are they not the same thing? It all comes down to where they've been mined and how they've been treated. You know, we're not just putting out a piece of carbon or something out there.
Right.
It really is. There's a major difference between something like Research and just a bunch of our other competitors.
Yeah, definitely. Brad, what kind of uses are you seeing your growers implement in Iowa and other parts of the Midwest?
I think use-wise, it's typically going to be application in that broadcast, and sometimes any urea broadcast like what Adam talked about, whether that's a pre or using urea as a side dress. I think one of the big uses as an efficiency tool really comes down to us. We've got a ton of data across the years on what hydrohumin research can do for our crops, but then to have that validated by external sources.
Okay.
Within the last 10 years now, it's not as fresh as it was, but we did some research with South Dakota State University.
Okay.
And so they conducted a 3-year trial looking at our dry humic with urea and our liquid with UAN. So at that time it would have been hydrohumic, so the same base ore, which we now have a more refined version of with Research. But what they found was a 15% efficiency. Right. Mm. And that's huge as we look to the future of what sustainability might bring into our marketplace. But even at a more simple level, what economics look like.
Right.
And that what I mean by that 15% was 15% less fertilizer, the same yield.
Mm.
Right. And we have internal data that validates that on P&K as well across the Corn Belt. So we have entire fertilizer recommendation systems. We call it our ASK blend, our advanced soil knowledge blend, that we utilize that efficiency built into that, so we can make, once again, more crop nutrition out of our fertilizer, right? And that's why we're seeing great yield returns on that with the same or sometimes even a lower investment fertilizer or a similar investment fertilizer and a yield increase, right? There's two ways to look at that type of math. When you can be more efficient with what you have, that's ultimately going to be a benefit to our yield by getting more nutrients in.
And Adam, let's talk to growers about and listeners about when's the best time to utilize Research and have it applied to your crop act.
I mean, we do a number of different things. You talk about the coastal bend. We're putting out our fertilizer in really October, November, because we've got a lot of acres to get across and not a lot of time to do it.
Sure.
So they're trying to get things out a little bit early. Really, pre-plant, you can go in season with it as well, as long as you can get that spreader across in a manner. You really don't put it out at a wrong time. But typically, a little bit of a pre-plant application is where we like to see it.
Okay.
Kind of get it mixed in there and cultivated in for aiding in uptake.
And you mentioned earlier, Research can be used on all kinds of crops. I mean, tell us about some of the crops again you're utilizing.
You're not limited to anything. It can go all the way across the board. And again, like I've said before, you're not going to make a wrong application in that matter. There's not many things in this business that I think are a silver bullet, but this is pretty close to it in the sense that you're not going to make it an application at the wrong time, and you're not going to make it on the wrong crop. It can go across everything.
And Brad, tell us about the safety of Research.
Sure, there's a lot of different aspects to that, helping to reduce volatility urea. You can see some crop injury from in-season applications of urea. We can help to knock that back with our humic acids. Even liquid humic acids have the ability to help buffer salts, right, out of fertilizer. If you're putting something in furrow and you're worried about it getting a little bit too salty and maybe causing a little bit of root burn, you can help to mitigate some of that crop risk injury. But outside of that, there's no issues of crop safety. I mean, I guess if you went out there with a pellet gun and shot it through a soybean field, you could get some holes in the leaves. That's about the only way I can imagine there being
sure.
some crop injury from something like a Research.
Well, you touched on it. Research is just one of those products. As we think about the buzzword, is certainly sustainability. As you walk around the commodity classic here, it's everywhere. Everybody's talking about sustainability. It's becoming a bigger part of agriculture. Research is one of those products that can definitely be a great start to a sustainable future.
Certainly. Yeah, that's one that when you think about sustainability, there's a lot of aspects. It's being more efficient with your nutrients, right? So it's maybe being able to apply less nutrients without having yield penalty. That would certainly fit into sustainability. one of the things that we've had documented, going back to that study I referenced in South Dakota State, was over a three-year period, they actually documented an increase in organic matter.
Oh, wow. Right?
And there's no way that you're going to put out 30 pounds of a product over 3 years and be able to pick up a percentage of that. But what that tells me is the other thing they pointed out was they had bigger plants. Right, they had bigger root systems that were more able to take up nutrients. They had bigger stalks. That puts more organic material back into the soil, and that can then become additional organic matter. And whether or not, however things are going to be rewarded and credited in the future with sustainability, you know, that's certainly not going to be a negative to that, and then be able to document something like that through our agri-intelligence system. The other place that kind of goes with that, and this is outside of a soil application, but we also use research in manure treatment. Mm. And one of the things that we consistently see is a significant increase in bacterial activity when we make an application of research into manure, and specifically aerobic bacteria, which those are the ones that are more beneficial toward mineralizing nutrients. And also, for anybody who's dealing with livestock, it's the anaerobic bacteria that typically create the odors, right? So we're helping to knock down some of that odor, even to the point where I've heard some confinements where they're having better air quality and seeing higher rates of gain because they're having that lower ammonia level in the air so that the animals are able to grow better. But that's an aside, going back to pointing out when you can have a documented increase in organic matter and in cation exchange in the soil, and then also showing positive benefits towards soil microbiology, right now you're really starting to get into that soil health, which is going to only, that's in my opinion, just one soil scientist out there, is soil health is going to be absolutely critical in any future that we have sustainability. For any of the more conservative programs of tillage, for how nutrient management's going to happen in the future potentially, they're all going to require our soils to have a lot of bacterial life so we can have high rates of mineralization and really capitalizing on all those natural processes that are in our soil.
Wow. A lot packed in there with research for sure. Certainly helping us become more sustainable and efficient, obviously, for the grower. And I think the big thing too, Adam, is the convenience factor. We touched on it on the beginning. Research is just one of those products that it's just easy to handle.
No doubt. I mean, it's one of those products where you really don't have to worry about a lot of application error. I mean, it's something that mixes easily. It's going to get out there and it's going to start working pretty quickly. I mean, we touched on it earlier, the ease of use of it. It's kind of like whenever I think about that humic granule, it's kind of like a tea bag. It starts seeping out immediately. Whereas a lot of other humics, the way that it works is it's kind of like a lollipop. It's slowly, water slowly taking it off one by one. So that quick and easy application is something that's great for us.
Well, guys, I want to thank you for joining us here today in the FieldLink podcast studio here in Houston, Texas, as we visit with growers about research as they get ready to plant 24. And we encourage them all to reach out to their local Helena representative to learn more about research and how it can make your fertilizer program more efficient in Plant 24. And now joining us from Nashville is our commodity host, Jody Lawrence. Jody, welcome to FieldLink.
Well, Bill, good to be back. I hope everybody had a wonderful Easter and glad to hear that you are healing up after your major surgery on your foot. So I think we're all heading in a good direction for the spring.
Hope everybody had a good Easter, and it is great to be back on the air. And Jody, boy, we had a recent report come out before the holiday from the USDA talking about planting intentions. Boy, what's going on? What's the latest report telling us, Jody?
Well, last Thursday, the USDA, they always put out their March quarterly stocks and acreage report, and it just so happened to coincide that it fell the day before Good Friday. So it was a big weekend of news, and then moving into the holiday, a nice transition into April. But the USDA surprised the market and the private analysts, because so many private analysts run their own acreage surveys and send out questionnaires to their farm customers. But the USDA came out with a number of 90.036 million acres of corn that they're estimating will be planted while the private estimates had that number going into the report at 91.776. So 1.4 million acres is, you know, roughly 125, 130 million bushels if you look at a normal trend line yield. So that was a nice bonus to get out of it. The stocks number was a little bit smaller, 80 million bushels than expected. So that you throw that together, there's 200 million potential bushels that are not there. But really the biggest thing when you look across the entirety of all the ag numbers for the intentions of acreage was that all planted acres fell by roughly 6 million. And when you look across corn and wheat, lost acres, beans are going to pick some up. Over last year's, they're going to pick up about 3 million acres, where the U.S., if we hit that 90 million acre, that would be almost 6 million acres below what we planted in 23. So these numbers are important. You can tell that the markets have done their job in an oversupply situation to where lower prices are making people make different decisions on what they're going to do for the 24 crop year. While input prices have held steady from 23, this certainly where prices are with December corn at $4.75 and November beans below $12, they're not motivating anybody to plant fence row to fence row like we saw in 21, 22, and 23. So those are the big ones that we'll have to deal with, but it ultimately comes down to you tell me how the weather is going to be from April 15th, which is a pretty widespread right. first insurance date for planting up until Memorial Day, and we will see how accurate that number becomes.
Really, Jody, you know, based on that report, it feels like, and based on where the commodity prices are right now, it really does feel like Mother Nature is going to drive a lot of decisions in the next 2 to 3 weeks. Is that fairly accurate from your perspective?
That's certainly accurate and always the case. And 2023 is a great example because coincidentally, the USDA, their estimate last year for planted corn acres in the March report was 91 million acres. And we planted nearly 96. So that just tells you right. that when corn is going in the ground well and that the U.S. farmer inclination to plant corn when they believe they're going to get that early planted yield bump, that mm-hmm. more corn acres go in. So this is something we're going to have to carefully watch because while the rally was nice, today gave back enough of it because farmers are hedging. Knowing that they need to take advantage of some of these rallies. But if we get good planting weather and a bigger number, a 93 million acre, let's say, in the June report, then all of this will be wiped out pretty quickly from a bullish outlook phase. So, yeah, it's all weather over the next 6 weeks.
And as some of the weather predictions have also come out here over the last few weeks, it sure feels like we're going to have, you know, fair amount of moisture potentially in the northern corn belt from Colorado through Ohio over the next 3 to 4 weeks. Jody, if that's the case, do you think we could see more soybeans planted in 24 if we continue to have this, you know, heavy moisture over the next 2 to 3 weeks?
If you get to a point and this comes from, you know, all the farmers that I talk to, that you really almost have to get to about May 10th, May 15th before mm-hmm. they have a high level of concern. Right now, the rain is very welcome because even though there were much better rains over this winter in a lot of areas, especially I know they're getting some now in the Western Corn Belt, Nebraska in particular, that is much needed. They still would rather have the subsoil moisture now and yeah. take the risk that the crop's a little bit late. I've never met somebody that would rather plant in dry soil and take that chance than take rain when they get it.
You bet. Well, definitely the next 3 weeks going to tell the story. It seems like based on the corn planted today, as well as soybean acres and really the cotton acres too. Jody, other than, you know, some of the commodities, how are things kind of finalizing things up in South America?
Well, you've got bean harvest in Brazil got past 80% late last week over the weekend. And as they head towards the finish line, we're going to get two major updates on April 11th, so a week from Thursday, that CONAB will give their government estimation of the size of Brazil's bean crop, and the USDA will also update it in their April 11th report. Remember that there is roughly a 350 million bushel difference between what the USDA says on the high side for those bean yield and what Brazil's own CONAB is saying. So that's really going to be a big deal to see if they come together or if the USDA just remains as that outlier with a much higher number than all the public and private estimators and analysts have that are, you know, in Brazil or have people in Brazil.
And finally, you know, we couldn't have a podcast, Jody, if we don't talk about oil. You know, as planters get ready to roll here, diesel's going to be in the air. Fuel's going to be on the top of a lot of producers' minds. What's your insight from the fuel side of things?
Well, crude has ticked back over and crawled up over $83 for the first time in several months over the last several trading sessions. And when you look at what's still going on in the Middle East, at some of the other issues, you've got intensifying spring bombing between Russia and Ukraine, and Russia is targeting a lot of both power facilities and some of their drilling and refining operations. There are enough supportive things in the market that any break should still be hedged. And the markets gave us plenty of opportunity, and I'm hopeful everybody took advantage of them early in the winter. But with everything going on around the world, especially Middle East, Russia, and Ukraine, we may be looking at steadily climbing oil and gas prices and unleaded and diesel prices over the course of the summer, unless some political maneuvering and solution can come up for either or both of those situations.
All right. Well, Jody, I want to thank you joining us from Nashville today for this commodity update for FieldLink. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bill. Everybody have a good week.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of FieldLink. Be sure to ask your ag retailer about Grounded. Spray smart in 2024. Get grounded.